Okay, so our second speaker today is Ron Schechter. Ron is Associate Professor of History at the College of William and Mary. He's published many works on terror in revolutionary France, including most recently two chapters in edited volumes, Terror, Vengeance, and Martyrdom in the French Revolution, The Case of the Shades, in a volume entitled Terrorism and Martyrdom from Oxford, and Conceptions of Terror in 18th Century Europe in Facing Fear, The History of an Emotion in Global Perspective from Princeton University Press. Ron has also published widely on the history of Jews in France, including Obstinate Hebrews, Representations of Jews in France, 1715-1815, which was published by UC Press in 2003. And most recently, which I'm intrigued about, a graphic novel entitled Mendoza the Jew, Boxing, Manliness, and Nationalism, which came out 2 years ago from Oxford. Today he will talk to us about terror and reassurance in the year two.
On September 5, 1793, in the midst of a massive insurrection against the National Convention, the Jacobin Claude Royer made a speech in which he famously demanded of the revolutionary lawmakers, "Placez la terreur à l'ordre du jour," a phrase typically translated as "make terror the order of the day." Although Jean-Clément Martin has argued that the convention never officially decreed terror to be the order of the day, the expression became very popular. And this popularity in itself is significant if we wish to understand the enthusiasm with which many French men and women greeted the laws, institutions, and practices that collectively came to be known simply as the terror. The Archives Parlementaires record 139 instances of people calling for or praising terror as the order of the day, from September 5, 1793, to the fall of Robespierre on July 27, 1794, 9th Thermidor. Among the lawmakers who used the expression were Barrère, Billaud-Varenne, Danton, Hérault de Seychelles, and Prieur de la Marne, all of whom served on the Committee of Public Safety and were active in implementing the terror. And more than a dozen other deputies are recorded as having supported terror as the order of the day. Representatives of the Parisian Section came repeatedly to the convention to make the same demand, as did members of the Jacobin Club of Paris. More than 50 provincial Jacobin clubs wrote to the convention, sometimes appending hundreds of signatures, to call for terror as the order of the day or praise the legislature for having accomplished that goal. At least 20 municipal governments sent in similarly worded communications, as did officials in charge of districts and departments, members of local revolutionary committees, soldiers at the front, national guardsmen, gendarmes, and ordinary citizens. In addition to these 139 instances, the Archives Parlementaires record nearly 600 occurrences of revolutionaries advocating or praising terror between the beginning of September 1793 and the end of July 1794. What was the appeal of the word terror? Why did revolutionaries use it to describe the laws, institutions, and methods of government that they wished to see implemented in their nascent republic? These questions are behind a larger book project tentatively titled A Genealogy of Terror in 18th Century France. My working thesis is that the word terreur in old regime usage frequently had positive emotional connotations. In religious writings, from the Bible to sermons, and even in the devotional expressions of philosophes, God is praised precisely because he is terrible, and the terror he inspires is a sign of his justice and majesty. In acclamatory political writings, monarchs and later nations are lauded as the terror of their enemies. Legal writings endorse the concept of the terror of the laws or the deterrent effect of punishment. theater criticism adapts the Aristotelian view that effective tragedies must inspire terror in spectators. Aesthetic writings insist on terror as a precondition of the sublime. And even medical writings often hold terror in high regard, characterizing it as a cure for numerous ills, including fevers, paralysis, gout, rabies, and epilepsy. I'm not arguing that terror never had negative connotations. Political writers decried the atmosphere of terror in despotic governments, though Montesquieu used the term crainte, or fear, in his description of the principle of despotism. And anti-clerical writers denounced the terror of hell that the church allegedly manipulated to its political advantage, though here the term terreur was usually in the plural. But there was undeniably a semantic tradition in which terror frequently evoked ideas of power, majesty, justice, and legitimacy. It was salutary, to use an adjective that often accompanied it. As such, I argue, it often felt good to utter, write, hear, or read the word. The revolutionaries inherited this tradition of positive terror speech. It felt good to them, too. Now, I can anticipate the objection that speculating on how revolutionaries or any other historical actors felt is hazardous. I admit that this is true, but it is no more hazardous than speculating on what the revolutionaries were thinking. More to the point, the very distinction between thinking and feeling is dubious. William Reddy has shown that cognitive psychologists, who should be able to tell us the difference between cognition and emotion, have failed to do so. And he prefers the term cogmotion, coined by psychologists Douglas Barnett and Hilary Ratner to describe the inseparable nature of cognition and emotion. My claim that terror speech felt good to the revolutionaries is based in part on the supposition that they did not create a radically new worldview or mentalité. In other words, that they inherited features of the culture of the old regime. But this hypothesis can be tested by closely examining the utterances, oral and written, of revolutionaries, and in particular during the year two, when so many revolutionaries were celebrating or advocating terror. Of course, to say that something felt good is not very precise. At specific moments during the revolution, terror speech could stimulate such feelings as a sense of power, joy, justification or vindication, holiness, or unity and friendship with like-minded people. It could also stimulate anger and hatred, which under certain circumstances were also pleasurable. But in my paper today, I would like to focus on a set of related emotions that we might summarize as reassurance. Revolutionaries often use the word terror in close proximity with the words hope, confidence, courage, and consolation. These terms constituted a semantic field that tells us much about the emotional condition of revolutionaries in the year two. Specifically, they point to the revolutionaries' own feelings of grief, privation, and ultimately terror. After all, why did revolutionaries feel the need to repeat the words hope, confidence, courage, and consolation, words that convey the very opposite of terror when invoking terror against the enemy? I believe that this configuration of emotion words reveals terror speech to have been, at least in part, a kind of therapy by which the revolutionaries sought to reassure themselves. Let's begin with the word hope, which could be regarded as an antonym of terror. If terror entailed anticipation of future suffering or unhappiness, hope pointed to a happy future free from suffering. In the political speech of the year two, the word hope, espoir or espérance, was often in close proximity with terror. For example, in a letter to the convention in the fall of 1793, the Republican Society of Grasse described the planned criminal code as the hope of the innocent and terror of the guilty. On January 17th, a deputation of the Popular and Republican Society of the Arts came to the bar of the convention with a civic crown of laurels and this compliment: "Your energy, carrying terror to the tyrants and rebels, at the same time carries the hope of happiness to all the peoples of the world." On February 18th, according to the minutes of the Popular Society of the Canton of Melo, which were sent to the convention, a festival inaugurating a temple of reason had taken place in which the leader of a procession of young boys carried a banner with the inscription, "Hope of the Patrie and Terror of Kings." Examples such as these could be multiplied. Closely related to hope was confidence or trust. And we also find confiance as a foil for terror in the Revolutionary Speech of the Year II. On March 8th, the administrators of the district of Le Dora wrote the convention in praise of the Ventose decrees, requiring the redistribution of property confiscated from suspects and émigrés. "It is in bringing such coup, wise legislators, that you will make terror the order of the day among all the rich aristocrats of the land, and that you will inspire confidence in the sans-culotte of all the nations." Similarly, on March 20th, the Popular Society of Auxonne wrote the convention in praise of the Committee of Public Safety, "whose revolutionary energy inspires as much confidence in the Republic as it does terror in tyrants." In the same lexical field as espoir, espérance, and confiance were the words courage, courageux, and encouragé. Revolutionaries typically juxtaposed the terror supposedly experienced by the enemy with the courage of French patriots. For example, on September 23rd, the Surveillance Committee of Essay wrote the convention boasting that it had taken all the measures that it considered suited to carry terror to the aristocrats and reanimate the courage of the patriots. That it was necessary to reanimate the patriots' courage hinted at the possibility that even patriots could be prevented by fear or terror from doing their duty. Similarly, the need for courage is seen in a letter by the administrators of the district of Montfort-la-Maurie to the convention. They wrote that the various setbacks to the revolution in 1793, such as the loss of Mainz, the rebellion in Lyon, the loss of Toulon, the siege of Dunkirk, and the continued civil war in the Vendée, have not weakened the courage of the French. On the contrary, they have only augmented it and made it become an object of terror for the enemies. The administrators claim that French courage produced terror in the enemy, but the causality might have been reversed. The belief that the enemy was terrified encouraged the French. At least it gave courage to the authors of this optimistic address. Or consider the letter that General Jourdan wrote to the convention on October 16, 1793. Jourdan described a bloody battle against the vile slaves and despots, in which 6,000 enemy troops were killed and 200 Republican soldiers were lost, and the city of Maubeuge was restored to French control. He ended his letter with this claim: "Terror has taken hold of our enemies, and I believe it would be impossible for these slaves to withstand the courageous efforts of our brave Republicans." As was typically the case in military bulletins, the purpose was to encourage, or literally give courage to those who had reason to be afraid, even terrified. While Jourdan characterized the terror felt by the enemy as a consequence of French bravery, his intention seems to have been to produce that bravery, at least in the civilians he was addressing, by assuring his audience that the enemy was terrified. More evidence of the need for courage among the revolutionaries and of the possibility that terrified enemies could be its source comes from a report by Barrère, who spoke to the convention on November 25th on behalf of the Committee of Public Safety and concerning the operations of the committee in the current campaign. Barrère insisted that only the Republic's enemies need feel terror, but he hinted that revolutionaries might be experiencing this emotion, and he contrasted it with courage and encouragement. It is not in the temple of liberty, in the center of the revolution, that terror must live, that courage must be frozen, that speech must be paralyzed. It is not here that souls must be timid, energy dulled, and that the character of the free man must be effaced. It is from this sanctuary that terror must go to restrain domestic enemies. It is from this tribune that must come rewards and encouragements for the armies of the Republic and fright for the foreign cohorts. Terror was encouraging because it was restraining the Republic's enemies. I have other examples of revolutionaries contrasting terror in their enemies and courage in their friends, but in the interest of time, I will move on to references to consolation, consolation, in terror speech. Following the liberation of Toulon in December 1793, the Popular Society of Parthenay held a celebration in which a citoyenne Thibault carried a tricolor flag and proclaimed, "May it," meaning the flag, "be the terror of brigands, the support and the consolation of good citizens." On March 5th, the Commune and Popular Society of Saint-Quentin sent a letter thanking the convention for a decree that had released 8 citizens whose arrests had been the result of intrigue. They wrote, "This act of justice will be the terror of the wicked. It has brought consolation to our commune." Likewise, employing a variation on the terror consolation dyad, they wrote, "Your decree has just brought into the soul of the oppressed ones a sweet consolation that changes into terror for the guilty." On April 4th, the Popular Society of Libreville wrote to urge the convention, "Continue to cast terror into the soul of the traitors and consolation into the soul of the Republicans." Calls for consolation implicitly acknowledged suffering on the part of the revolutionaries. That suffering might have been from privation or grief. It might also have stemmed from feelings of fear or terror. I say might, and in the statements quoted so far, I have speculated that perceived terror in enemies was precisely what produced reassurance in the revolutionaries. Yet, in numerous statements, revolutionaries made this connection explicit. For example, on November 14th, Deputy Hérault de Seychelles, on mission in the Haut-Rhin, wrote his colleagues in the legislature of the sad state of affairs in the department, where sans-culottes were being insulted. And he insisted, "Only terror can establish the Republic here and give courage to the small number of patriots." Similarly, on February 26th, Danton called for a decree requiring all revolutionary committees to submit a list of their members to avoid false accusations. He declared, "It is thus that the revolutionary instruments will become still more useful, and that terror remaining constantly the order of the day against the enemies of the revolution, the patriots will be able to be secure in peace and liberty." Finally, on April 16th, shortly after the execution of Danton and his supporters, the Popular Society of Souillac wrote to congratulate the convention. "Representatives, the striking justice that you have just exercised toward these audacious criminals by imprinting terror on the brow of the guilty, emboldens, raises the soul of true Republicans." Statements such as these suggest what we might call the principle of the conservation of terror. According to this logic, insofar as the enemy is terrified, the revolutionaries could feel hopeful, confident, encouraged, emboldened, consoled, in a word, reassured. It is not surprising, given this way of thinking, that revolutionaries projected their own fears onto their enemies. The appeal of such fantasies helps to explain the popularity of the terror and the eagerness with which so many revolutionaries proclaimed it the order of the day. Enthusiasm for the word terror, which felt so good for revolutionaries to utter, write, hear, and read, carried over to the policies denominated by the same word. In other words, the appeal of terror, with a small t, helps to explain the appeal of the terror, with a capital T.